So
I'm going to talk about a paper in progress with Alberto and Enrico Trencherini, who is a postdoc in CISA in Trieste. So the idea is to use the Lagrangian Alberto was talking about, not as a possible explanation of the present acceleration, but as a possible alternative to inflation, which we call Galilean genesis in the sense that Galilean in the sense that it's based on this Galilean symmetry, and genesis because when I will show the scale factor, you will see that there is basically the scale factor rises at a certain point, like a creation of everything from Minkowski space. So first of all, I want to talk about the null energy condition. The reason is that the important feature of this alternative inflation is the violation of the null energy condition. So I want, first of all, to review why this condition is important for cosmology and why the Galilean Lagrangian can violate this energy condition. So let me be brief on this. What do we mean by energy conditions in general relativity? Well, in general, we are trying to say something like to state that the energy is positive, which is what we intuitive think. Of course, this is not a covariant statement, so you have to put some index in to make it a covariant GR statement. There are various energy conditions, but let me focus on two of them. One is the strong energy condition, where Xi is a generic time-like vector. A weaker one is the so-called null energy condition, which is the one I'm going to focus on. Notice that K in this case is null, that's why it's called null energy condition. And notice that the first implies the second, because in the limit in which this vector becomes null, I end up with the second. So in some sense, this is a weaker requirement on the stress energy tensor. So, okay, why these energy conditions are important? Well, in cosmology, we are mostly interested in, at least for the background, on a stress energy tensor of this form. So let's see what these conditions are on, in this case, the stress energy tensor. Well, the important point is that the strong energy condition is for sure is violated in cosmology. Of course, the strong energy condition, which amounts to say that rho plus 3p is positive, is something which holds for normal matter, for matter or for relativistic species. So in general, at the beginning, one expects that our universe will be driven by something like a normal matter, like a star so at the beginning, cosmology, we're taking this condition as satisfied. But, of course, if you think about it, our revolution, if you want, in cosmology in the last 20, 25 years was the realization that at the end there is no reason why the whole universe should be dominated by standard matter. By standard, I mean matter which satisfies the strong energy condition. And indeed, the present acceleration is most likely due to a violation of a strong energy condition. And inflation, if it exists, is indeed a violation of a strong energy condition. So both these phases of the universe are based on a violation of this energy condition. Notice that indeed one of the Friedman equations implies that the strong energy condition in the case of cosmology is one-to-one to the fact that the universe is or is not accelerating. So violating the strong energy condition is the same as saying that the universe is accelerating. So, okay, now okay, we accept that the strong energy condition can be violated. After all, if we take a positive cosmological constant, this will violate this inequality, and we think that there is nothing wrong in putting a positive cosmological constant. So, okay, the strong energy condition can be useful to prove theorems, but it's not something which is generically, for any theory I write down, is not something which is generically satisfied. So let's try to something weaker, which is the null energy condition, which, as I said, it's also interesting because once you accept a cosmological constant, for sure you have to look for something weaker, and you want to look for something which is insensitive to a cosmological constant, okay? Because there is nothing wrong in choosing a positive or negative cosmological constant. So if you want an energy condition which is satisfied by any possible Lagrangian I write down, then it's nice to have an energy condition like this, which is insensitive to what the cosmological constant is, because Kelvin proportional to GV nu, it gives zero in this inequality. So both from this point of view and also because it's a weaker condition than the strong energy condition, it's a natural candidate for some inequality which is satisfied by all possible matter. So what the null energy condition implies, well, it's easy to see that if you plug in the standard isotropic form of a stress energy tensor, you get an inequality like this, which is which sometimes is written in terms of this W parameter as saying that W is larger than minus 1. Using the conservation of a stress energy tensor, well, we have this equation in general. So you see that the positivity of rho plus p implies a very intuitive thing, which is that in an expanding universe, rho decreases. At most, it stays constant, like a cosmological constant, but we don't want that it increases as the universe expands. Or another way to say the same thing is that the null energy condition is one-to-one to the fact that h dot is negative. Okay, so in a universe which satisfies the null energy condition, there is always, as time goes on, h decreases. Okay, so it's which is quite an intuitive statement. Now, what if we give up with this assumption? Well, if you think about it, there are many, many things that we take for granted which may be wrong if we are able to violate the null energy condition. One is the existence itself of the Big Bang, in the sense that, okay, the Big Bang is the intuition that if I go backwards in the past, the universe becomes smaller, H increases, and at a certain point, it will exceed the cutoff of my theory, and I call this Big Bang. Okay, so even in inflation, okay, it's true that it goes arbitrarily in the past, but still there is a need to complete the theory. Okay, so but if this is based on the assumption that the null energy condition is true, or we can do something that we're going to study in our example, the possibility that the universe was born in a state with very low energy, okay, even with H going to zero in the far past. So in some sense, in this case, we are starting the universe. So the universe takes its origin from a very low energy state, and then all the energy is created, and we have then the standard evolution. The null energy condition is also important for bouncing cosmologies, because by bouncing cosmology, I mean all the cosmologies in which the present expansion is preceded by a contracting phase. Okay, now, of course, to connect these two regions, to the two behaviors, you need a bounce, which is the region in the transition between contraction and expansion. Okay, now there are various possibilities. People study the possibility that this regime of connection lies outside the regime of validity of four-dimensional effective theory. In this case, you have to think about string theory or whatever. But if you want to remain in the standard four-dimensional effective theory, you have to violate, again, the null energy condition. The reason is that of course, H is negative during the contraction, is positive afterwards, so you need a point where H dot is positive. So again, bouncing cosmologies need a violation of an energy condition. And then finally, also the present acceleration, we saw many talks this morning, whether the equation of state can be less than minus one is related to the null energy condition. Of course, in this case, there is also the confusion that we may see an effective equation of state which is smaller than minus one, but because, for example, matter is coupled to a scalar and so on. On the other hand, here I'm talking about the real expansion of the Einstein frame metric. Okay, so this is a possible caveat. Okay, so you see, I try to convince you that the energy condition is something which is very intuitive, and we based many of our intuitions on this condition. Okay, so yeah, so for me is some kind of Pandora's box. So once you give up with this, then you can really do whatever you want in cosmology. So you can have a bouncing universe, you can start from nothing, and so on and so forth. So I think it's a very important point to understand whether this box is completely closed, there is no way to get around it, or it can be open. So very briefly, what's wrong in general with a non-energy condition? Well, in general, it's associated with the instabilities. Okay, this, for example, is not the case for a strong energy condition, because we said that, for example, a positive cosmological constant violates the strong energy condition and without any pathologies. But the non-energy condition is much tougher to violate. The standard example is a ghost, which is a scalar field in which I put a minus sign in front of the whole Lagrangian, so that the Hamiltonian has the opposite sign. Of course, it doesn't need much intuition. I mean, of course, a sector of my theory now has the wrong sign of the energy, so I am in the presence of an instability, because the two sectors anyway would be connected, at least gravitationally. This is even worse quantum mechanically, because there is nothing to prevent the decay of the vacuum into positive and negative energy states. Okay? So, of course, this is a well-known problem. But one may wonder whether this situation is generic, or there are just the simplest example, which does not work. I must be brief, but so a first indication that you must find something clever to violate the non-energy condition comes from this paper by Alberto and friends. And this is also an indication why we are using the Galilean, why the Galilean is a good candidate for violating the non-energy condition. Well, I don't want to review the theorem, but in general, studying a generic Lagrangian as a function of many scalars, where I is the index of running over all the scalars, one can prove in quiet generality that when higher derivative terms can be neglected, okay, then we can stick on the lowest order terms in the Lagrangian, then there is a quite strict connection between the non-energy condition and the absence of pathologies, which are either gradient instabilities or ghost instabilities. In particular, if we take an isotropic solution, which is what we want for cosmology, then this relationship is one-to-one. So if you impose if you require that there are no pathological instabilities, then you must have the non-energy condition. So this tells you that if you want to get around it, you need a theory in which these higher derivative terms play a role. For example, the Galilean. Yeah.
In
this case, they are considering many. I mean, the theory is completely general in the sense you have many scalars. This was the question.
Yes. So yeah. Even if the background violates non-energy condition, necessarily one of them becomes instable.
Yes, actually, I'm talking about the fluctuations. I mean, if I have a background solution for these scalars, mm-hmm. which violate the non-energy condition, then the fluctuations around this background, they have some pathology. One of these, the degrees of freedom that will carry the pathologies are the goldstones associated with these solutions. So these are the ones that will have a pathological dispersion relationship. Okay, so we know that it's, in general, we understand why we tend to neglect these terms in the conventional effective theory approach. The idea is that, in general, sufficiently low energy, these kind of operators, I wrote one, but I mean the whole series of them, are negligible compared to the previous ones. And so in the regime of validity of the effective theory, usually one is forced to neglect them. Okay? In general, the presence of higher derivative terms, like this one, for example, is signals the presence of a pathology. Actually, through a field redefinition, one can show that this is a ghost. It describes an additional degrees of freedom, because now the equation of motion contains more derivatives. But this additional degree of freedom is a ghost. It has the wrong sign of the kinetic term. So in general, if you don't, if you're not looking for particular examples, higher derivative terms are pathological, and they cannot be described in the regime of validity of the effective field theory. So let's see what are the exception to this theorem. So very briefly, first of all, I want to review that the Gauss condensate is a possible violation of this theorem. I mean, it's for sure it's a counterexample of this logic. I don't want to enter in details, but let me just remind you why there is a possibility of violating this theorem. The reason is that for the Gauss condensate, which is one of the theory Alberto was talking about, which was introduced as a possible non-Lorentz invariant modification of gravity, the displacement relationship is of this form. In the sense, it's degenerate in the sense that the gradient term is zero. Okay, so it's, of course, in this case, it's not an option to look for higher derivative terms, because actually you don't have gradient terms at the lowest order. So it turns out that the leading gradient term in the Lagrangian is given by higher derivative term. So the logic here is quite different, because the theory is intrinsically not Lorentz invariant, in the sense that Lorentz invariance is spontaneously broken, and the fluctuations around the background, they are completely not Lorentz invariant. They have this no relativistic dispersion relation. So that the usual, the counting of the dimension of operators in the effective theory changes, and the logic is a bit different. That's why the theorem does not apply. So there is a counterexample. And in fact, this was used to construct in this paper solutions which violate the analogy condition, which are cosmological solutions in the sense they are isotropic. And it's the first example of opening this Pandora's box. It's not possible to completely open it, in the sense that there is still some tension in these theories. It's not possible to make H dot very big. It's possible to make it positive, but not very large. Actually, we have to remain in a regime in which H dot is at most of order H squared. So there is a violation, but there is still some tension that we have to play with. And this gave, then you can try to apply this logic to build a realistic, quote unquote, realistic alternative to inflation. For example, this was used to build bouncing cosmologies in these papers, which goes under the name of new Kipirosis, whatever. So the idea is to use the Gauss condensate as the source of null energy condition violation, so to induce the bounce, okay? Then, of course, life is not easy. Then you have also to generate a scale invariant spectrum of perturbations, which you need an additional you need some additional sector of the theory. And it turns out that you can play with an additional scalar moving along a negative exponential potential and to generate a scale invariant spectrum. So we are trying to do better than this in some sense. And first of all, what we see is that in these models based on the Galilean, first of all, this condition will not be a problem, in the sense that you can violate an energy condition as much as you want. You can have H dot very large compared to H squared. Okay, this is an improvement. And one feature that I like is that we will see that the reason why you get a scale invariant spectrum of perturbations is quite tight. I mean, it's quite economical, in the sense that you're not going to play with an additional sector with additional symmetries and so on, but it comes quite naturally in the theory. Yeah. I'm sorry, yes, I skipped through it. Actually, the Gauss condensate, it goes to a solution in which the stress energy tensor is proportional to a metric, is like a cosmological constant. So it's not really a solution with violated energy condition. So you need to perturb a bit the solution. But of course, you know, you're already at it's easy to do so, because the Gauss condensate is a solution in which a scalar field is evolving, but with a stress energy tensor, which is just a cosmological constant. So now if you start playing with it, for example, you add a potential to this scalar, then you start deforming the stress energy tensor, and of course in one direction we get a violation of an energy condition. Yeah, so you need to deform the theory to get to this. Okay, so this was a long introduction. Now briefly, let's get to the to our model. So Alberto already explained everything about the Galileon. So there is something I should say, but no. No. So this is just what Alberto said. Actually, I need something more. So Alberto was focusing his attention on scales which are much smaller than the Hubble scale. But for us, it's mostly a technical reason. But we're going to extend the Galilean symmetry to a more general group, which is the conformal group. Actually, so let's review the symmetries of our model. So we have the Poincaré group plus translations, so our 6 plus 4 generators. And then we have the Galilean group, which are 5, translation of pi and translations of the derivatives of pi. Okay. So in total, we have a 15-dimensional symmetry group, which actually matches with the number of generators of the conformal group, SO4,2. Okay. Actually, well, the counting is not enough, but you can easily realize that if I write down these are dilation, and this is the spatial conformal transformation, and these and I state that pi transforms like a dilaton, okay, like the standard dilaton transformation. So in the limit of small pi, okay, these symmetries they just reduce to the one Alberto was considering. So this if for small pi reduces to a translation of pi. And again, for small pi, this is just a shift in the derivatives of pi. Okay, so this is to say that you can see the Galilean transformation as the limit for small field values of the conformal group. Okay, how do I construct a theory which is has these symmetries? Well, the easiest way is to promote to write down an effective metric, which is e to the 2 pi. Eta mu nu, okay, which in some sense, again, is a generalization of what Alberto was doing. Alberto was expanding this exponential and considering 1 plus 2 pi, so I'm going to get nonlinear in pi. And to write a Lagrangian, which is invariant under the conformal group, I have to write down a metric invariant, in terms of this fictitious metric. So I will start writing down Ricci, Riemann of this metric and do all the possible contractions. And this gives rise to a conformal invariant theory. So what happens at the level of the pi Lagrangian? Well, there is, in the limit of small pi, you can check that these are the generalization of, let me come back. So these, if you remember, are the quadratic and cubic piece of the Galileo Lagrangian. So now, if I promote the Galilean symmetry to this conformal symmetry, then these two terms are promoted to this, which you see, for small pi, this reduces to the kinetic term. For small pi, again, this is negligible compared to this, because it has the same number of derivatives, but one additional pi. Okay? So indeed, it's a check that these terms, it makes sense that they are the nonlinear extension of the Galilean symmetries. Okay? Okay, so I have Lagrangian, which is invariant under SO4,2. Okay? And now I'm going to study solutions. In particular, given that I have this large amount of symmetries, it's not surprising that I will have solutions with a lot of symmetries. Okay? So some symmetries will be broken, but in general, I expect that many symmetries will remain unbroken. And in particular, I expect that I will have solutions which are De Sitter invariant, SO4,1. Okay? So again, this is a generalization of what Alberto was doing, but now I'm talking about exact De Sitter solutions, not only at short distances, but exact De Sitter solutions for this fictitious metric. Okay. Okay, so let's study the model. Let me concentrate on only these two Galilean terms. So again, this is one term. The two are related by this conformal symmetry. And this is the quadratic piece. I mean, if I take into account also all the other Galilean terms, the analysis will be more complicated, but there are no, I mean, the essential features are the same. So let me restrict to this, to the simplest version. Okay, as I said, we expect to have the Sitter invariant solution. And indeed, one can check that this Lagrangian has a solution in which the fictitious metric is the Sitter. Okay, this is the conformal representation of the Sitter. So time for us will run from minus infinity towards zero. And this is a solution provided that A0 is related to the parameters of my Lagrangian in this way. Okay, okay. So what else? So let's now, let's for a moment forget about gravity. So let's just consider this Lagrangian in isolation, okay? And Planck is infinity, no gravity. Let's look at the stress energy tensor of this action. Well, it's easy to see that if you plug this inside the action and I calculate the stress energy tensor, all terms goes like 1 over t to the fourth, which is a consequence of the residual dilation symmetry. So the stress energy tensor will be a constant, I mean, tv nu, but time independent. I mean, it's just a numerical tensor, times t to the minus 4. Now, we are in flat space. So in flat space, given that gravity is decoupled, the conservation of a stress energy tensor says that rho dot is equal to 0. There is no expansion. So, of course, given this and the fact that rho dot is equal to 0, it means that rho is equal to 0. While the pressure is proportional to 1 over t to the fourth, and one can check that both signs are possible depending on the coefficient in the Lagrangian. So this is a funny feature, in the sense this Lagrangian, in the limit of decoupling gravity, has zero stress energy tensor around this solution and negative pressure. Okay. So, of course, this is a gross violation, a brutal violation of a non-energy condition. Okay. So let's turn on gravity now. Okay. Let's. Yes.
Have the Sitter symmetry, and then that's the zero. And
yeah. So this is confusing. Actually. Because I'm using the same language for two different things. So one thing is the fictitious metric given by the scalar. So the same metric that he was considering before. So this is the Sitter, not because there is a proposal constant or nothing, but just because this Lagrangian is SO4,2 symmetric, and it's not surprising that one of these solutions is SO4,1 symmetric. But the gravitational background would be completely different. So here I'm neglecting gravity, so the time being is completely flat. In this, rho is equal to zero, so there is no So, and Planck is infinity. Now let's turn on gravity and see what is the gravitational background. Well, you can see from here, h dot is proportional to rho plus p. Rho is negligible, so this goes like 1 over p to the fourth. So h
will be given by an expression like this plus an integration constant. So notice a few strange features. Well, first of all, h goes like 1 over m Planck squared. Okay. Usually, it's not like this. Usually, h squared goes like 1 over m Planck squared. Okay. So it's not a typo. It's the statement that in the limit in which gravity is decoupled, this Lagrangian has zero rho. Okay. It's only when I couple it to gravity, then there is a small deviation. So if you want rho is of order 1 over m Planck squared, so that h squared will be 1 over Planck to the fourth. Okay? So this is one strange feature of this model. Okay. Of course, you see that there is a gross violation of an analogy condition. So h, we are going towards 0. So h is positive and is blowing up at t equal to 0. Another interesting thing is that I have this concept of integration, which can be whatever I want. Well, I have to be, of course, now I will study perturbations, but of course I have to be close to the unperturbed solution. But it's important that I can, in this model, I can start both in contraction or in expansion. This Lagrangian will always drive me to expansion. Okay. So this is a strange feature because usually is not the case. Usually there is no explanation why we are expanding, in the sense we take for granted that we are expanding at the beginning, and then we expand and h dot decreases, so we expand and slow down. Okay, this is the conventional scenario. Here, no, I can start in contraction or in expansion. Anyway, this will be forgot as t going to zero, and I will expand and with an increasing Hubble parameter. Yes.
So if I take the metric that you define by eta mu mu multiplied by e to the pi, and I calculate h, this is a constant, right? That h is constant.
That h, sorry, you take this metric and I calculate the ridge, Ricci, for example?
Well, h.
H is a constant, yes.
This is a constant.
Yeah.
So when you say I turn on gravity, what do you mean?
I mean that, So in this part, there is no gravity. In a sense, okay, to build my SO4,2 invariant action, I pretend that this is a metric. Okay. For example, then I can couple particles to this metric, and then some particle feel this as a metric. But if you don't have any other particle in the game, this is like a fictitious metric that I like to call metric, but it's nothing to do with Gmu. Okay. So here I'm talking about probably it's a sort of confusion. So this H0 is a parameter characterizing the scalar field solution, okay? But it's nothing to do with why this H is the Hubble parameter of the metric, the real metric, the Einstein frame metric, if you want to, okay? It's clear? No, it's, yeah, it's a bit, I guess it's confusing.
So doesn't energy momentum conservation tell you that if density is zero, then in an expanding universe, homogeneous expanding universe, pressure should be zero as well. Rho dash plus gx.
Yeah,
so this is conserved in the...
So this statement is only valid in the limit and plan with infinity, so without expansion. Now, if I start expanding, then rho will not equal to zero. We corrected by terms of order 1 over n plus squared, and that's why I end up with this solution. Okay so...
Hello?
Yeah.
So just to make sure, so is it true in this theory, in Einstein frame, the metric is Minkowski, and in Jordan frame, in Jordan frame, you have this dissident solution which comes entirely from the conformal factor?
This is true in the limit and plan with infinity.
Only in the plan and plan.
Yes, because, or if you want at early times, I mean, if you forget about this constant, let's put it this way. If you forget about this constant at early times, I end up in Minkowski, in a sense, the Einstein frame metric is Minkowski. The Jordan one will be Minkowski plus, I mean, maybe at the simple space.
Which means at early times you are not solving horizon problems, but at late times you are. Is that what you're saying?
Why at early? Let's concentrate on the Einstein frame metric.
Yes.
Okay. This it goes to Minkowski in the past. Right?
Yes. You know, is this theories that people talk about in the past where you kind of inflate by basically a conformal transformation?
No. Sorry.
But here, I get that it's not quite that.
No, because I think it's the same. Sorry, yeah, I think it's the same conclusion that we go ahead. So, again, this the sitter, I'm not using it to solve any cosmological problem. It's just, I mean, I call it the sitter because it's an SO4.1 invariant solution, but. You can forget about it if you. I mean, it's not just, so. The evolution of my, I mean, the Einstein frame evolution of my model is given by these equations, which are super accelerating solutions. Okay, so yes, I'm not using the Jordan frame metric to play games like no.
Okay.
Okay. So another funny feature of the model is that if you integrate this equation. You get a strange behavior for A. I mean, it's not a power law, but it's an exponential of 1 over t squared. And this comes from the fact that H is not, it does not go like 1 over t as usual, it goes like 1 over t to the cube. So that's why, in some sense, we call it genesis, because,
I mean, in practice, the scale factor is A equal to 1, and then it blows up when I approach equal to zero, so it's really like an instantaneous creation of energy from nothing. So now what we have in mind? Well, of course we don't know what happens when t approaches zero, in the sense that at a certain point we will reach the cutoff of my effective theory. Okay, so I will I cannot trust this description anymore. So the idea is that at this point, I will probably change description. I will probably create radiation and start the conventional decelerating universe. Okay? So I have some sort of reheating, which for us will lie at when this effective theory breaks down and I have to change description. Okay. How much time do we have?
I guess we'll start 5 minutes. So.
Okay, so the background is okay. Now, the perturbations are very subtle, okay, so we had many problems. Why they're subtle? Okay, first of all, one can check that this solution that I described is a homogeneous attractor, okay,
in the sense that I take k equal to zero, and I check whether the solution, which I call the sitter, is an attractor, as, for example, in inflation, and it is, in the sense that perturbations, if I start with a different speed, for example, compared to this the sitter solution, I will approach these in the past, in the future. So in some sense, I end up in a perturbation which is just the same solution shifted in time. That's good. So in particular, you can also check that even if you start with a contracting universe, still you end up in an expanding universe with this solution. Now, the next step could be to study the perturbations at finite k, okay? Let's first of all neglect gravity. Usually, this is not a good practice, in the sense, usually it doesn't make much sense to neglect gravity. For example, in inflation, you cannot, usually this scalar will be mixed with gravity, so you cannot just study it in isolation. But remember that in this case, the whole thing has a smooth limit and Planck going to infinity. I mean, so it's different. So I can study the perturbations, which I call the phi, around this the sitter solution, okay? I mean, one may expect that, I mean, we are trying to get a scale invariant spectrum of perturbations, and the hope to get it is the fact that the fictitious metric is the sitter-like, okay? Indeed, if you study, these are the perturbations around this the sitter solution. These the perturbations, they look a lot like a scalar living in the sitter. Well, the reason is that, again, I mean, if I neglect gravity, this scalar fills only the background solution, which is has the sitter symmetries. So indeed, you see that it has the kinetic term of a scalar field living in the sitter. The problem comes from the fact that there is a mass term, which again is unavoidable, is fixed by the symmetry, so it cannot be tuned, and so that the spectrum is not scale invariant. The situation gets even more complicated when you, okay, let's try to do things in a standard way. So we write down the action for the gauge invariant variable zeta, which turns out to be of this form. So you get two modes, which one goes like a constant, one goes like 1 over t. Okay, zeta equal to constant is what we like in general. Okay, for inflation, this is the dominant mode and it's conserved on supervised on scale and so on. Here it's trickier because the dominant mode goes like 1 over t. Okay, so this mode is there, but it's not the dominant one. Okay, so this creates a bit of confusion. The bottom line is that what's happening is that we are exciting not the standard adiabatic mode, but the other one. Without entering too much into details, in this paper by Weinberg, for example, it studies the various adiabatic modes in Newtonian gauge. Okay, so adiabatic modes are modes which, on very large scales, they just reduce to a gauge transformation, in the sense that they have no physical meaning at k going to zero. So they are associated with gauge transformations. So what it does in this paper is that you consider a gauge transformation in which you define the time variable and you redefine the x coordinate. And then you impose also the Einstein equation. So you impose that psi is equal to phi in Newtonian gauge. So you end up with a constraint between this function epsilon and this constant lambda, which is given by this. Okay? So this is the most generic adiabatic mode in Newtonian gauge. Okay, usually the standard adiabatic mode is associated to this constant lambda because this goes 1 over a, so it decays in an expanding universe, while this goes like t, so it's dominant compared to this. And if you plug this expression back into this, you see that this corresponds to the usual relationship between zeta and phi. So it's the standard zeta equal to constant mode. So in our case, on the other hand, what we excite is this mode, which turns out to be dominant because 1 over a is practically constant for us, while this goes like t, which goes to zero in the future. So you're dominated by this term. So that's the reason why here we got a strange behavior going like 1 over t. Anyway, so the situation is subtle, also related to the fact that the limit and Planck going to infinity does not commute with the limit of small perturbations, so you have to be careful. But anyway, so the bottom line is that if you are careful enough, you realize that the spectrum of perturbation of adiabatic, in a sense created by this mode, is irrelevant cosmologically, in the sense that either it is very blue, or in a particular limit, actually, there is no perturbation at all. So there is no relevant cosmological perturbations. So, okay, so what do we do? I mean, we have no perturbations, but we want a scale invariant spectrum. Well, the scale invariant spectrum may come, again, from the fictitious metric. Okay, so the logic is again, similar to what Alberto was discussing before. So for the present acceleration, okay, one possibility is that, maybe it's not really acceleration, but matter is coupled to a scalar, and the scalar describes an accelerating metric, okay, let's do the same for the primordial universe, okay? So we have a scale invariant spectrum. We think that it comes from a De Sitter metric, okay? But maybe not. Maybe just comes from, again, from a fictitious metric, which is De Sitter-like, okay? So how does it work? Well, as I said, I have to write a Lagrangian, which is a function just of this metric, okay? So, for example, if I have an additional scalar which is coupled to pi, it has to be coupled to this metric, okay, which is De Sitter-like. So I'm just saying that if I have an additional massless scalar field, it will think, it will believe to be in De Sitter, so it will have a scale invariant spectrum. Okay? And this is different from the usual story. This comes from the symmetries of the Lagrangian, in the sense the solution. I start with a SO4,2 invariant Lagrangian. The solution has the De Sitter invariance, so that every field living in this solution will give rise to a two-point function, which is the De Sitter invariant. Okay. So all the signature, of course, will be the same as like when you generate perturbations through a second field. So in general, I will expect local Lagrangianities. Gravitational waves are very suppressed and strongly blue, associated with the violation of an energy condition. And again, given that I have to rely on a second scalar field, it's possible to have isocurvature. But there is nothing, not much new in these, because these are common to all the second field mechanisms to produce perturbations. Yeah.
But on the two fields, you have pi and what is that?
Yeah, sorry, I was not really, I didn't introduce the name of the second field. I'm saying that any additional scalar must be coupled to pi through this metric, because otherwise I break the symmetry. So if it will believe that it is in the Sitter, so it will give rise to a scale invariant spectrum. So I'm not specifying the details, then it can work like a curvaton, it can work like a variable decay,
whatever. So. I'm not specifying because I don't know the way then these perturbations will be converted into adiabatic, but it is similar to what happens in inflation. Okay, let me wrap up. So, yeah.
Well, the exit again is a bit of a mystery. As I said, this background solution describes something H which is diverging. So at a certain point, this description breaks down. I reached the cutoff of my theory, okay? The strong coupling scale of the theory. So at this point, of course, this description does not work anymore, and I expect, anyway, to convert the energy in some other degrees of freedom, which I hope they give rise to the standard decelerating universe. So I'm not specifying anything. I'm saying that this description breaks down at a certain point. So these energies must be converted to some other degrees of freedom. And
before you're going to calculate your spectra and stuff like that, does it depend on the matching, the wavelengths when they exit? You have to see when they re-enter. It depends on how you exit, essentially.
Well,
yes. The production of other stuff.
Yes. Yes. Similar to what happens in inflation, in the sense. If I have only the adiabatic perturbation, then I can apply the usual arguments that zeta is conserved, blah, blah, blah. But this is not a source of perturbations for us, because it's very suppressed. So, of course, to calculate what the second field is doing, I would need to specify the details of reading. This is not different from an isocurvature scenario in inflation, in the sense.
I'm talking about very simple thing. For example, to see the stuff on the sky, like what I'm seeing now in CMB, is like coming from about, I don't know, 60 volts from the end of inflation, right? So the amplitude of these modes depend by the value of Hubble back then.
Yeah.
Right? So in your model, how does this, clock counting work?
So you're saying that I don't know So in visual language, I don't know when reading happens.
No, it's like what the wave modes are you see on the sky in this model. Like,
I don't think it's so different from mutation. In the sense, I can assume some instantaneous reading.
Okay.
In the sense that when I reach the cutoff of my theory, mm-hmm. then I assume that from then now on there is radiation dominance. Of course, it's completely model dependent, and this will fix the correspondence between the modes. But if reading is very long, very short, then it will be different, and so on. No, I agree, no, in the sense, the details, the fact that the spectrum is scaling invariant will be remain true, but then how these perturbations are converted, how you match the modes in the sky to the primordial universe will depend on how reading happens.
So, to summarize, this case that you have, and Planck, obviously, the cutoff of the theory that you assume to be...
The cutoff of my theory is lambda cube. You want to count the number of...
I'm just saying, there will be some hierarchy, you expect one to be much bigger than the other, I don't know,
Usually is taken to be of order n Planck, but I don't think there is any strong motivation in this case. In the sense, I'm just taking this Lagrangian from the other application of a Galilean. In this case, F fixes the modification of gravity. So if F is of order n Planck, the modification induced is of order 1. Okay. But here, this lambda is the cutoff of my theory, and I don't have any justification of the scales. The spectrum will be fixed by this H0, which is this ratio of scales, because the second scalar field will feel that is in this fake sitter. So H0 is normalizing the perturbations. Okay.
So the 10 to the minus 5 of the CMB would that ratio?
The point is that, the two-point function of the second scalar field is normalized H0 squared over K3. But then you have to convert to adiabatic perturbations, and this there is...
Unknown.
Yeah, it works I don't have any justification for the scales or... Nick, is there something?
We're pretty close.
I'm done. So, the predictions, I was trying to look at... this is quite similar to what happens to these new equipirosis models. So I have low gravitational waves, so probably undetectable, very blue. In one case, because H dot... The tilt of Cassini wave is the time derivative of h squared. So in this case, h is positive and h dot is positive, so I have a blue spectrum. In these models of bouncing models, I have h dot is negative because they do not violate an energy condition during contraction, but h is negative, so it turns out to be positive again. But again, probably it's very difficult to detect, so it would be an interesting smoking gun, but very difficult to observe. I think local non-Gaussian is, it's just a smoking gun for a second field mechanism. Given that all these models, they are not able to produce with a single field everything, they are quite ubiquitous in these models because they just show that they are not able to do everything with one field.
What did I want to say? It's more a philosophical thing. So, I think that in these models, the deviation from scale invariance is not, it's difficult to take a point of view, but what is true is that the typical percentage deviation from scale invariance that you have in inflation, which is quite natural because it comes from the fact that you are approaching the end of inflation, so it's not completely general, but it's quite robust. In this case, this number could be whatever you want because the source of perturbations is the second field. So I'm just saying, in other words, what I'm saying here is that if we are completely sure that an element of the Dovish spectrum is completely ruled out from data, I think this is already a good point in favor of inflation. While in this case, I can easily cook up models in which this deviation is as small as I like. So, and then there is the fifth prediction, which is for sure Linde's paper will come out to criticize ours. supernormality, this is the last slide. I just have to repeat what Alberto said. Notice that in the sitter background I'm looking at, there is no violation of, propagation is luminal because of the symmetries of the sitter, so there is no superluminal propagation. But if I start perturbing the solution, then I can go in the direction of supernormality. Okay? So the solution, by chance, has no problem, but still I can deform the solution to create superluminality. So probably, again, this points toward a non-Lorentz invariant UV completion, if this UV completion exists. I think that it's not completely clear whether this superluminality is one-to-one with the violation of an energy condition. So it's not clear because that's it. It's just the summary. Thank you.
Okay, so maybe since we're running behind and there are a lot of questions, may I suggest that in the interest of catching up a little bit, is there a burning question and can't wait for coming? That was that introduction the answer to that question. So maybe we should be back in at 4:15. Is that enough time?